In the summer of 1912, a four-year-old boy went missing while his family was camping near a Louisiana resort area. The day Bobby Dunbar disappeared was the day the lives of three families began to turn upside down, and it would take almost 100 years to find answers to the questions that hung over these families for generations. This is the mystery of the disappearance of Bobby Dunbar. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Imagine a child has disappeared, gone missing, has been missing for 8 months. Imagine this is your child, and you get a call from authorities in a neighboring state saying they believe they found a child that matches the description of your little one. You travel to the location, and when you arrive, you're asked to identify the child, prove it's your son or daughter. What would you look for first? What features would you point out to prove this is your child? Birthmarks, scars, little details only a parent would know about their son or daughter. If you are a parent, I'm sure things immediately come to mind. But imagine a child has been missing for 8 months, and his own mother can't identify her child. It seems beyond the realm of possibility for most parents. But that was the case in 1913, when the parents of little Bobby Dunbar were asked to travel to a small town in Mississippi to see if a child who had been found was their missing son. And that was only the beginning of one of the most twisted and unbelievable missing child cases in American history. Some decisions you can live with, and some change your life, whether you made the decision to protect someone you love or made the decision to cover up mistakes and try to hide your regret. It's the decisions you make out of fear that can haunt you and lead you to the kind of scandal that began near a lake in a small town in Louisiana in the summer of 1912. Percy Dunbar was part owner of an insurance agency in Opelousas, Louisiana, in St. Landry Parish. He was married to Lessie Dunbar, and by 1912, they had two young boys, four-year-old Bobby and two-year-old Alonzo. The family lived in a yellow house that faced Main Street. In the summer of 1912, Lessie and Percy were over the heat in their town, so in August, they decided to take their sons to Swayze Lake for the week. This was a popular resort area where the family would relax in cabins and enjoy time camping and fishing with family and friends who would join them on this trip. Percy had to leave the cabin on the morning of August 23rd. He had a business meeting in a nearby town. Percy planned to return later in the day to join his friends for a fishing outing. That day, when Percy went to leave, little Bobby Dunbar begged to go with his dad, but he was told he needed to stay at the lake with the family. When Percy returned to the lake later in the day, he wouldn't go on that fishing expedition. Percy was met by his wife, Lessie, who told him that Bobby had disappeared. Earlier in the day, four-year-old Bobby had asked to join a family friend to shoot fish at the lake with a few other people in their group. His mom agreed, but soon after the group returned from the lake, Bobby's mom realized that Bobby wasn't with them. He was out of sight for about 15 minutes, and little Bobby Dunbar was nowhere to be found. Depending on who you ask, which family tells the story? That was the last day Bobby Dunbar was seen alive. Lessie Dunbar was initially calm as she and fellow family members and friends searched for little Bobby. But Lessie became understandably hysterical when a search party traced him to the banks of Swayze Lake. Authorities assumed he had drowned and worked alongside hundreds of volunteers to recover his body. Those volunteers searched the muddy, dark waters around Swayze Lake looking for any trace of the four-year-old. They pursued every lead they could, even slicing open the bellies of alligators to search for remains of the child. And authorities went to an even more extreme measure. They dynamited the lake. They thought the blast could dislodge the child's remains if he was indeed stuck in the mud and the sludge. But there was no sign of Bobby Dunbar. A few days later, Bobby Dunbar's hat was found a significant distance from the lake, which led to new hope that Bobby could be alive. But as the search continued and Bobby wasn't found, authorities had to pursue not just the theory that Bobby was lost, had wandered away, but the theory that Bobby Dunbar had been kidnapped. Volunteers and those searching for Bobby had found small footprints that led to a railroad track. Add in the rumors of a strange person who had been seen in the area the day Bobby disappeared, and the Dunbars began to believe that Bobby had indeed been kidnapped. Mrs. Dunbar was grief-stricken and unconsolable. But the folks in Opelousas held on to hope and kept up the search. But it seemed each new clue would send hope crashing back down, wouldn't lead them to any sign of Bobby Dunbar. They wondered if a reward could help. Thanks to Percy Dunbar's work, his career as a real estate and insurance agent, the Dunbars were a fairly prosperous family, well-respected. They were people of means. Percy Dunbar began to wonder if Bobby had been kidnapped for ransom. So Percy offered a $1,000 reward. That's the modern-day equivalent of $25,000. Then the people of Opelousas joined in the effort, raising an additional $5,000 for the reward money. All in all, the town and the Dunbar family offered up a reward that would today amount to a little over $125,000. The family always made one thing clear. They wanted their son back, and if whoever took him returned him, they could have the money. No questions asked. Percy Dunbar also hired a detective agency to print up postcards with Bobby's picture and send them to town and county officials from Florida to East Texas. This was the description of four-year-old Bobby Dunbar that was printed on the back of postcards. Large, round blue eyes, hair light but turning dark, complexion very fair with rosy cheeks, well-developed, stout but not very fat, a big toe on left foot badly scarred from burn when a baby. Newspapers ran stories not about a missing boy, but about a boy who had been kidnapped. They featured pictures of Bobby Dunbar next to his pictures of his parents and his two-year-old brother, Alonzo. Stories that were printed in newspapers all over the region. Police did get a lot of tips about potential sightings, but they were tips from people who were hoping to cash in on missing Bobby Dunbar. The tips police found to be less credible were picked up by the Dunbar family, who personally spent money and time hiring detectives, even sometimes sending out family members to follow up on these leads. But still, nothing. Weeks and months passed, and hope began to fade. In the fall of 1912, a group of men were arrested and accused of kidnapping Bobby. But evidence came to light that they were innocent, and they were set free. That arrest had given the Dunbar some hope of, at the very least, getting an answer as to what had happened to their son. They just needed to know where he was and who had taken him and why. Any parent of a missing child can tell you how Leslie and Percy Dunbar felt after weeks and months of searching, hope renewed, then crushed again. They were broken emotionally and mentally. That was until April of 1913. That's when authorities sent a telegram to the Dunbars, asking if they could come to a small town in Mississippi and identify a boy who matched the description of Bobby Dunbar. On April 13th, 1913, a man named William Cantwell Walters was arrested near Columbia, Mississippi. Arrested as a suspect in the kidnapping of Bobby Dunbar. Walters was a peddler from North Carolina who occasionally worked as a piano and organ repairman. Folks in a town called Hub, Mississippi, had noticed that he was traveling with a boy who matched Bobby Dunbar's description. Same age, same blue eyes, blonde hair. When authorities questioned Walters, he said the little boy who was traveling with him was Charles Bruce Anderson. Bruce, as everyone called him, he was the illegitimate child of Walters' brother and a woman who worked for his family. Her name was Julia Anderson. Walters told police that Julia knew her son was with him and that he had not taken the child without the mother's permission. William Walters explained that months earlier, in February of 1912, the boy's mother had placed her son in his care because she was unable to support her child. Due to the publicity surrounding the disappearance of Bobby Dunbar and William Walters' nomadic lifestyle, police had already questioned him a few times. And remember those tips that police didn't find credible, but would pass on to the Dunbar family to investigate themselves? Bobby Dunbar's own uncle had personally investigated William Walters and the young Bruce Anderson months before and concluded that he wasn't his nephew. But due to the hefty reward for the return of Bobby Dunbar, people were continuously contacting police to report that Bruce Anderson was really the missing Bobby Dunbar. And so it was that police once again questioned William Walters and told him they didn't believe his story. They took custody of the little boy, arrested William Walters, and sent word to authorities asking the Dunbar family to travel to Mississippi to identify the boy. When the Dunbars arrived from Louisiana, authorities expected that there would be a grand reunion, or at the very least, they hoped for a happy ending. But there was one really big problem. The Dunbars reportedly didn't recognize the child who authorities said was their son. As is true of most of the newspaper accounts of the Bobby Dunbar events of 1912 and 1913, what happened the day the Dunbars met with the boy in Hub, Mississippi, comes down to which newspaper report you believe. One reported that the moment Lessie and Percy Dunbar walked into the room, the boy was asleep. When he woke up, he yelled, "Mother," and ran to Lessie Dunbar to give her a big hug. Another report said the boy woke up, cried, seemingly upset at the sight of Lessie Dunbar, and Mrs. Dunbar said she couldn't be sure if this was her son. According to Percy and Lessie Dunbar's family, both of them weren't sure the boy was their son. They pointed out that he didn't seem familiar and his eyes were too small. And they were both exhausted and broken from 8 months of searching, 8 months of hoping that they would find Bobby, and then facing setback after setback. The newspapers also disputed the boy's reaction to being united with the Dunbar's younger son, Alonzo, Bobby Dunbar's baby brother. One claimed the boy didn't recognize Alonzo, but another news account said the boy immediately called out to Alonzo and kissed him. But news accounts were united when it came to what happened the day after the Dunbars met with a boy believed to be Bobby Dunbar. The next day, Lessie Dunbar was giving the boy a bath, and that's when she said she saw a mole on the boy's neck and scars on his left foot. Scars that the news had mentioned when describing the missing Bobby Dunbar. It was in that moment that Lessie was said to have shouted, "Thank God, it's my boy." And with the blessing of the courts, the Dunbar family returned home to Opelousas, Louisiana on April 25th, 1913. And that was the day it seemed like everyone in St. Landry Parish showed up at the party and the parade that welcomed little Bobby Dunbar home. The joy for the Dunbar family meant pain for Julia Anderson, the woman who William Walters claimed to be the mother of the boy he had been traveling with. And it led to fear for William Walters. He was facing the death penalty. While in his jail cell in Mississippi, waiting to learn if he would be extradited to Louisiana, Walters wrote a letter to the Dunbars, pleading with them to call for Julia Anderson, the woman he said was the mother of the boy the Dunbar family had taken home and claimed was their son, Bobby Dunbar. Walters begged the Dunbars to hear Julia Anderson's story, writing, I know by now you've decided you're wrong, and it's very likely I will lose my life on account of that. The Dunbars never replied to William Walters, never called for Julia Anderson, but a New Orleans newspaper made arrangements, helped pay for Julia Anderson to travel from her home in North Carolina to Opelousas, Louisiana. Julia was a single mother who had been working as a field hand. She had no lawyer, no money, no means to travel all the way to Louisiana on her own. And the folks at the newspaper wanted answers. By now, the whole country wanted answers as to whose child had been found in Mississippi with William Walters. The newspaper decided to help Julia Anderson because they knew they could get a good story out of it. And they believed that Julia shared one thing in common with Lessie and Percy Dunbar. She was the parent of a missing child. William Walters had claimed Julia gave him permission to travel with her child because she was unable to care for him on her own. But in an affidavit from Julia that was printed in a newspaper in 1913, Julia clarified her side of the story, saying that she had indeed given William Walters permission to care for her son, but not to take him out of state. She said she had asked him to care for her son for 2 days, and she hadn't seen her child, Bruce, in over 13 months. When Julia arrived in Opelousas, Louisiana, she was hoping to be reunited with her long-lost son. But police ushered her into a strange lineup of young boys. They took her to a home where they had a lineup of 5 boys who were around the age and appearance of her son, the boy she said had been misidentified as Bobby Dunbar. The boy who had been traveling with William Walters was in the lineup. Those in the room that day said that the little boy didn't call out for his mother when Julia Anderson entered the room. And Julia told police that she couldn't say if any of the boys were really her son. The next day, Julia was allowed to take a closer look at the boy she thought could be her son and was allowed to undress him. And when she did, she said she was positive this was her son, Bruce Anderson. This wasn't Bobby Dunbar. But Julia faced new obstacles, questions of her credibility. The boy would not say this was his mother. To this day, some folks believe the boy was the son of Julia Anderson, but his mother was poor, and the Dunbars had a lot of money. They were showering him with new gifts, including a new bicycle and a pony. He wanted to stay with the Dunbars, so maybe that's why he didn't speak up. This was a little boy's dream come true. All the toys and the money you could dream of and never had. Julia faced more scrutiny once word had gotten around town that she wasn't able to identify her son the day before. She faced scrutiny for this when Lessie Dunbar, not knowing if the boy was her son, Bobby, was mentioned in passing in newspapers and seemed forgotten soon after. When people learned that Julia Anderson was the mother of 3 children, all born out of wedlock, newspapers painted Julia in a very negative light. They called her a woman of loose morals. They revealed that one of her children had died. Her surviving daughter had been given up for adoption because Julia didn't have the money to care for her. Julia Anderson was poor and had no means to pay for a lawyer to fight for her son in the courts, to defend her integrity in the newspapers. So the Dunbars, with their money and status, once again took the boy home. Julia Anderson didn't return to her home state of North Carolina. She returned to a small town called Poplarville in Mississippi, a town that embraced her and supported her, believed her story and welcomed her, helping her to find a new job and a new place to call home. But back in Opelousas, Louisiana, rumors were flying. The boy known as Bobby Dunbar had been welcomed home, but people couldn't help but wonder, who was the little boy living in the Dunbar's yellow house near Main Street? Was it Bobby Dunbar or was it Bruce Anderson? William Cantwell Walters was formally extradited to St. Landry Parish, Louisiana, and stood trial in 1914. It was a sensational trial that gained national attention, particularly the testimony of 20 witnesses who said they had seen William Walters with the boy months before Bobby Dunbar went missing. and the testimony of Julia Anderson, who returned to Louisiana to corroborate William Walter's story that he had been given permission to care for her son, even if he did keep her son longer than she believed he would. He may have been using the boy to help him gain some sympathy and affection along the road. Remember, he was a peddler who worked odd jobs traveling across the South, and oftentimes, children helped put people at ease when someone was trying to sell something to them or asking for help. That worked especially well back in the early 20th century, when people were more willing to trust rather than question a stranger. But the testimony and defense of William Walters, well, it fell on deaf ears. The jury found William Walters guilty. His attorney filed an appeal with the Louisiana Supreme Court. And within 2 years, William Walters was granted a new trial. But new trials cost money. Money the St. Landry Parish wasn't willing to spend to try him again. So 2 years after he had been sent to prison, William Walters was released and would never be tried again. He was a free man, but a man who was haunted by the initial conviction for the rest of his life. After he was released from prison, William Walters went back to his work as a peddler, moving from place to place. Along the way, he would occasionally speak to groups about what had happened to him and how it changed his life. From time to time, he visited family, and when the subject of Bobby Dunbar came up, he was always willing to talk about it and always maintained his innocence, saying it was Bruce Anderson who went to live with the Dunbar family in 1913, that whether they realized it or not, the Dunbars had done to Julia Anderson what someone had done to them. They had kidnapped her child and claimed him as their own. And that was the story William Walters maintained until the day he died. As for Julia Anderson, she settled down in Poplarville, Mississippi. She married again, worked as a nurse and a midwife, and had 7 children. But Julia Anderson never forgot her little boy, Bruce. She spoke of him openly and often, telling her 7 children that they had an older brother who had been stolen and was living with a family in Louisiana, the Dunbar family. As you can imagine, there was always tension when Julia Anderson thought of, spoke of, the Dunbars. And there was tension for the Dunbars when Julia Anderson was brought up in conversation. Julia's family was said to be afraid of the power of the Dunbars. They felt that they had stolen little Bruce Anderson and had gotten away with it. But the Dunbars brushed off Julia Anderson, saying she was a confused woman. Julia Anderson died on February 1st, 1940, never having her prayers of a reunion with her son answered. Even after her death, her family continued to insist that Bobby Dunbar was her son, Bruce Anderson, who had been taken from her. Deep down, Julia's family believed that someday they would be vindicated and the world would know that Bobby Dunbar wasn't the boy who went home to Percy and Lessie in 1913. You would think the Dunbars would be happy. They believed their son had come home. A miracle, as some described it. But after William Walters' conviction in 1914, the Dunbars' world, it seemed to crumble. Public opinion turned against the Dunbars, with people either believing they had stolen Bruce Anderson from Julia, or people in their own town just being plain tired of the whole story. And how Percy Dunbar seemed to milk the story for publicity for his insurance company, and even pursued a political career. A few years after the trial, Lessie Dunbar left town. And in 1920, Percy Dunbar beat and stabbed a man while he was on a trip in Florida. Coincidentally, the attack happened on the 8th anniversary of the day Bobby Dunbar had disappeared. And Percy was unfaithful to his wife. After a very public scandal involving Percy and his habit of affairs, Lessie filed for divorce. But the Dunbars would have 2 divorces in 1927 because they couldn't agree on how and where to divorce. Lessie got her divorce in Florida, and Percy got his in Louisiana. Percy remained in Opelousas, Louisiana, and continued to work in his insurance business until he died in March of 1931. In the 1950s, Lessie returned to Louisiana and married Sidney Hardens of Bunkie, a town that wasn't far from Opelousas. But Lessie wasn't known to have much of a relationship with her older son, Bobby, the miracle who would come home to her in 1913. Bobby Dunbar was always questioned about his identity. He believed he had been kidnapped, that he was indeed Bobby Dunbar, not Bruce Anderson. But during his childhood and teen years, there were still so many people who questioned the Dunbar story. And the family dealt with multiple scandals, including Percy's affair and their divorce, which led to Percy Dunbar sending both Bobby and his brother Alonzo away to military academy. And according to an account from Hollis Rawls, a son of Julia Anderson, Bobby Dunbar came searching for answers. In 2008, Hollis was featured in a documentary about Bobby Dunbar on This American Life. He shared that in 1944, he was at work in his hometown of Poplarville, Mississippi, when a man came in, started talking to him, just shooting the breeze, talking about life and the weather. After a while, this man introduced himself to Hollis, said he was from over in Opelousas, Louisiana, and his name was Bobby Dunbar. Hollis was surprised, taken aback, was given a little time to process what he had heard, and then a customer came into the store. When Hollis returned to where the man had been, he was still there, and Bobby Dunbar stayed for a while, made more small talk, never speaking about what had happened in 1913. Just chatted, and then left. Hollis would later say that this day, this chance to ask Bobby Dunbar more questions, but sticking to small talk, was one of his biggest regrets. He would always wish he had just flat out asked Bobby Dunbar what he remembered, and if he came searching for peace, or if he believed he could be Bruce Anderson and had possibly come looking for his mom and even siblings. Hollis regretted it even more when he learned that the same thing had happened with his sister, Jewel, who had been at work at a service station she and her husband owned in Poplarville when a man came in, got some coffee, and sat down to chat with her, on again, off again, for about an hour. He asked her all kinds of questions about her family, but he never said he was Bobby Dunbar. But she had put two and two together, and she knew it was Bobby. In 1963, Bobby Dunbar's family were traveling home from a wedding they had attended in Ohio when they passed through Mississippi and they stopped at a little service station in Poplarville. Bobby Dunbar told his family that the folks in this town had helped get him back home to Louisiana when he was a kid. Bobby went inside the service station to chat for about half an hour and then left. As you learn more about the Dunbars and how their lives turned out, you see how Bobby Dunbar could have had questions. There seemed to be a divide between the whole family. It was Bobby's younger brother, Alonzo, who inherited their father's estate when Percy had died in the 1930s. And locals say that by the time Bobby was an adult, he was estranged from the family, whether by his choosing or theirs, we'll never know. Bobby had a fine education, became a certified electrician, and moved to Houston, Texas, where he built his own life. He met and married his wife, Marjorie, had four children, and supported his family by working as a salesman for an electrical supply company. All in all, Bobby Dunbar seemed to create a really good life for himself until March 8th of 1966. Bobby Dunbar suffered a massive heart attack and died at the age of 57. His obituary in his local Texas newspaper noted what you would expect, his wife and his children, even six grandchildren, but it didn't note one of the most historic missing child mysteries in U.S. history. And his obituary on the front page of his hometown newspaper in Opelousas, Louisiana, noted his passing, but made no mention of the kidnapping of Bobby Dunbar. The mystery of Bobby Dunbar's kidnapping and the mystery of what happened to Bruce Anderson continued due to their respective families sharing the story from generation to generation. Different stories, but enough to keep questions alive. And solving that mystery became a personal crusade for Bobby Dunbar's granddaughter, Margaret Dunbar Cutright, who was given an old scrapbook in 1999. Inside of that album, she found countless newspaper articles, photos, and letters about her grandfather's disappearance back in 1912. As she read those old papers, she began to ask more questions, even wonder if her grandfather had been the real Bobby Dunbar, and decided to do what hadn't been done in decades. A member of the Dunbar family reached out to a member of Julia Anderson's family, the granddaughter of Julia Anderson. Now, Linda had been told by her family that her grandfather, Bruce Anderson, had been kidnapped, wrongly taken by the Dunbars back in 1913, and he had been raised as Bobby Dunbar. And so it was that generations after the kidnapping of Bobby Dunbar, these granddaughters worked together to find some answers, prove their family's version of events once and for all. But after research and interviews and investigating this case for themselves, Linda and Margaret were once again left with contradicting tales. Linda believing Bruce Anderson had been taken by the Dunbars, and Margaret believing her grandfather was really Bobby Dunbar, had been kidnapped and returned home to his rightful family. Tension rose between the two families, each wanting to defend their own and the story they had heard for generations. Then came the option of DNA. By the early 2000s, DNA testing was growing in popularity, and the women knew this could be a way to finally get some answers they had never had before. It took years, with Margaret Cutright asking for her family's blessing to test DNA and get an answer to a mystery that had hung over the Dunbar and Anderson families for so long. Bobby Dunbar's son, Bobby Jr., initially, he didn't like the idea. His father was Bobby Dunbar, and he didn't need a test to prove that. But as a favor to his daughter, Bobby Jr. agreed to offer a sample of his DNA to be tested alongside a sample given by the son of Bobby Dunbar's brother, Alonzo. If he was really Bobby Dunbar, his DNA would be a familial match with Alonzo's. The test was conducted in 2003. A month after the samples had been submitted, Margaret Dunbar Cutright got a call that she and her family never expected. The man she had known to be her grandfather, Bobby Dunbar, carried no familial match. The Dunbars were shaken. Some members of Margaret's family didn't even know she had pursued the DNA test. They were hurt and frustrated. They thought she had dropped it. And Bobby Dunbar's son, Bobby Jr., at first he was speechless. Everything the Dunbar family had believed for generations had been taken away with one DNA test. They found the results overwhelming and wondered how to move forward, and some of them didn't. Some members of the Dunbar family haven't forgiven Margaret for pursuing the DNA test, felt she had disrespected her family, especially because it was all made public due to the story being such big news and the results being so shocking. All that mattered to them is that they were Dunbars, and there was no changing that. But Margaret and her father, Bobby Dunbar Jr., decided to travel to meet in person with the descendants of Julia Anderson. Bobby Jr. would later say in an interview that he had agreed to the DNA testing so he could prove he was a Dunbar. He was 68 years old at the time and maintained that the results may not have turned out the way he thought they would, but he would do it again to get to the truth. And as he put it, he had no plans to change his name because his daddy was still his daddy and his mother was still his mother. To him, that test didn't change that. The truth can leave you breathless. It can lead to loss, but it can add a lot to your life. For the Dunbar and Anderson families, the truth added new relationships. Many of the Dunbar and the Anderson descendants now call each other friends and say they hold no ill will. They're just happy to have answers to at least part of the mystery. Margaret Dunbar Cutright once said that the mystery of what happened to Bobby Dunbar and Bruce Anderson was like a 10,000-piece puzzle with no photo or guide as to how to put those puzzle pieces together. After the DNA test, 9,999 pieces were done, and the one missing piece, the piece that may never be found, is the mystery of what really happened to Bobby Dunbar. What happened to the 4-year-old the day he disappeared? Back in 2008, when Margaret Cutright was featured in the This American Life program that aired the documentary called The Ghost of Bobby Dunbar. She said she believed that the real Bobby Dunbar may have fallen into the swamp at Swayze Lake. And on that August day, he may have been taken by an alligator. But there is one other theory that was presented as to what happened to Bobby Dunbar. This theory was brought forth at the trial of William Walters in 1914. A theory that William Walters may have been traveling with two boys, Bruce Anderson and Bobby Dunbar. Maybe this could explain why two boys had been lost, but only one had been found. While a convenient theory, it was never proven. All 20 people who testified during William Walters' trial said they saw him with one boy. After the DNA testing revealed the answers the Dunbar, Anderson, and Walters families had been waiting for, the family of William Walters invited Bobby Dunbar Jr. to a family reunion they held at Lumber River State Park in North Carolina. They invited him to offer a blessing. During the reunion, a descendant of William Walters read a portion of the letter Walters had written while sitting in his jail cell in Mississippi in 1913, when he was waiting to learn if he would be extradited to Louisiana to face the death penalty. Despite his insistence of innocence, Walters knew that if he stood trial, a jury may not believe him, and he may lose his life for a crime he didn't commit. Walters wrote, "It seems that I must suffer now for an imaginary sin or crime that has never been committed. Dying, I can look up through the blue of heaven, thank God, and say my conscience is clear. The heartstrings of weeping mothers bind not my withering limbs, and the crime of kidnapping stains not my humble threshold door." In 1913, Percy and Leslie Dunbar experienced what's been called a miracle. Their missing son, Bobby Dunbar, came home. But as time would reveal, there was tension within the walls of the Dunbar home. Even as William Walters' trial was unfolding, the Dunbar's world was unraveling. And part of it may have been guilt, regret, and a decision made that affected the Dunbars, the Andersons, and William Walters, who's been proven to be an innocent man. When Margaret Dunbar Cutright was given that old Dunbar family scrapbook about Bobby Dunbar and the missing child case that shook America, she found a handwritten note inside the book. It was from Leslie Dunbar. It had been addressed to her granddaughter, who would be her caregiver, as years passed and she knew her time on earth was fading. In the letter, Leslie Dunbar shared, even though she and Percy had the help of their legal team and had won custody of Bobby Dunbar, she always had her own doubts that the Bobby Dunbar she brought home from Mississippi in 1913 was her child. Leslie seemed haunted by the idea that she may have brought home another woman's child. She may have raised Bruce Anderson. Leslie was haunted by that because she had lived in denial for so many years, had been afraid of what might happen if the truth came to light. And she allowed that fear and denial to fill a hole in her heart, the sorrow of knowing she had lost a child. But as time passed and she was facing her mortality, facing her life decisions, she seemed to come to terms with the fact that a mother knows her child. A mother always knows. And this mother knew, deep down, that after he went missing in 1912, the real Bobby Dunbar never came home. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. You can learn much more about the Bobby Dunbar mystery and find a link to listen to the Ghost of Bobby Dunbar documentary in the show notes at southernmysteries.com. There you can also listen to previous episodes and subscribe to Southern Mysteries so you never miss a new episode. In addition to this podcast, I also host a historical true crime podcast called The Color Line Murders. You can listen and hear those Southern true crime stories at colorlinemurders.com. And because you're listening to Southern Mysteries, I'm going to assume you like history and all things Southern. You can see photos of historical sites I visited across the South, along with the backstory on my Explore the South blog. You can find that at shannonballard.com. Thanks so much for listening.